You are listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 5720 Ridge Avenue. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday evenings at 5 p.m.
So there was this process that Jesus went through with his friends when they run into the blind guy, right? And they say to him immediately, "Who sinned? This guy or his parents?" And Jesus is very immediate, and he says, "It was not because of his sin or his parents' sin. This happened so the power of God could be seen in him." Jesus does not care a whit about blame. He's interested instead in seeing God's intervention. So who sinned? I think that's pretty common question. Don't you feel it underneath almost all the time? Who can we blame? We're interested in figuring out that in our politics almost every day. Our interest in who is right and who is wrong seems to dominate our lives, I think, in many ways. And so in Lent, as we attempt to enter into Jesus' suffering and to allow him to enter into our own, I began thinking about these questions of right and wrong and how they just can utterly destroy relationships and break hearts. We all mess up, and we struggle to own that when we do it. And we sort of seemingly have this innate desire to blame, and then we end up feeling bad about blaming, or we feel bad that the people we blame resist taking responsibility for our hurt. And it can really be excruciating, genuinely, to not get the apology that we long for, that we want. Or the last option in all of this is that we feel bad getting blamed and we resist considering what the blamer says. Almost instantaneously, we resist it. So here at the beginning of Lent, I want to talk about apologies. And I want to talk about good apologies in particular, kind of practically. And I think these are very difficult to find. So here's my personal theme story about how an apology I longed for and didn't work out and how God intervened anyway. So I was in therapy fighting a very, very stubborn depression. And I was learning about my relationship to my family, particularly to my very anxious mom. And I sort of had developed this pattern of caretaking that was very hard for me to see, and so really hard for me to break that pattern. What I mean by caretaking isn't really love, although I think that's what I thought it was. I learned early on to ignore myself, deny my needs, and just about noticing anything about myself, certainly my desires, in order to serve other people around me. That was sort of the way to do that in my family, in the way I took it in. And so the heart of my depression, really the heart of my anguish, had something to do with feeling sort of worthless and even invisible. But I was, of course, actively participating in perpetuating that by caretaking, by ignoring myself. I was just all the more implicit in that. I also carried, as so many people do, I think, in our culture, this need to do for others perfectly and, you know, this sort of amped up the self-neglect, even the self-abnegation. So it came along, this was many years ago, it was my 34th birthday, and my mom gave me a makeup mirror. None of you are close enough to notice, but I do not wear makeup. In fact, I had not worn makeup since I was 14 years old, which was in the 60s, and I had gone the hippie route, long blonde hair, cut off jeans, no makeup. So a couple of decades of no makeup. And so what was the meaning of this mirror was the question that came to my mind. Total non-recognition of who I am as a person? That was certainly a possibility, I thought. I told my therapist about this, and she said to me, "You need to give that mirror back." My response to that was an immediate, unchecked, unfiltered, "No way in hell." So I kept the mirror for 5 months, sitting on the dresser in my bedroom, ruminating on what I was going to do with this thing. Finally, I wrote a 2-page letter starting with all the ways I appreciated my mom and ending with, I'm giving the mirror back because it hurt me. I don't wear makeup. So the implication there, I don't think I got much of this in the letter, but something about this missing of who I am, wondering what it was supposed to mean. Was it a signal of her evaluation of me? I needed to start wearing makeup, i.e. I needed to change into someone that she could like. So anyway, I delivered this mirror back to her at her home when I knew she would not be home. I was not brave. I didn't hear anything from her for almost 3 weeks. Now, this may not seem significant to many of you, but we lived only about 15 minutes apart, same city in Southern California at the time. And I was in ownership of the four young gods in her life, Joel being, of course, paramount in those. But I had her grandsons, all of them. My brother had not offered any grandchildren yet. So I had all the grandkids. So this three-week gap was significant. And I had resolved to just wait. I was trying not to do my caretaking thing. And I had decided it was important that I give the mirror back and that I make myself wait for her response, any response, and I would absolutely accept any gesture. And so about 3 weeks went by, and I got a brief typed note that said, I'm sorry you feel that way. That was it. I'm sorry you feel that way. That is a very bad apology. But I called her right away anyway, reconnected. I knew, somehow I think I knew, that that was really all that she could do. That was the best she could offer. But it really was not a good apology. However, it did start a long, long process in me that led to a great deal of good, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. So what's actually needed in a good apology? Well, we've done some research on this. Studies have found that statements that have any element of denial, i.e. it really wasn't my fault, any of that stuff hinted around in the apology, it's not gonna wash. That's evasion. Or maybe that's just denial. Evasion is more like, well, it was kind of complicated. When people were asked, that is not what they wanted in an apology. So no denial, no evasion. On the other hand, apologies containing elements of some kind of corrective action. I won't do that again. I'll really try hard not to do that again. Or we even like better, mortification. I'm ashamed of myself. These get higher ratings for people making apologies. Satisfaction was higher following an apology that was actually intense or sincere. There was some feeling on the part of the person giving the apology, and it was empathic. It had a sense of how the other person might have felt about being hurt. It was timely. It came at the right time. It didn't go too long. A little bit more, just because when I started researching this, I thought it was fun. To no one's surprise, a 2010 study published in Psychological Science showed that women apologize more than men because women are more likely to believe they need to apologize. I thought that was interesting. According to this study, men apologize less frequently than women because they have a higher threshold for what constitutes offensive behavior. This, of course, made me think that that is why women often talk about these multiple apologies, but also, sorry for the political reference, but I think it's kind of why a president may be able to dismiss boasting about sexual assault as simply locker room talk. Bad apologies, of course, aren't relegated to just men. We're all pretty good at them. Another interesting study from Harvard Business School, what do they have to do with psychology? Well, probably more than we want to know because it has to do with selling us things. But anyway, in 2014, they did a study on apologizing that apologizing for even things that aren't your fault can make people trust you more. I love this study. So what they do is they send a researcher into a crowded Boston train station, and he's going to go around and ask people if he can borrow their cell phone. Happens to be this really rainy day, just miserable day in November. And so for some of these encounters, he begins by saying, "I'm so sorry about the rain." And then he asks if he can borrow the cell phone. So he apologizes for something he can have no control over. It's completely superfluous. And 47% of the people he approached gave him their cell phone if he mentioned the apology for the rain, whereas only 9% offered the cell phone when he did not apologize for the rain. So, being on the receiving end of a sort of superfluous apology kind of makes us trust a stranger enough to hand over a super valuable personal item. Why would they do that? I'd argue that I think this is because we all really long for a good apology, and we all carry hurt that's never been apologized for. We feel disconnected a lot and we want to reconnect. We find a reason to trust again. We wish we could find a reason to trust again, I think. But becoming aware of these longings for reconnection requires a high level of vulnerability that is simply very, very, very hard for us human beings. We mostly live trying to figure out how to avoid hurt, right? So we don't want to apologize or be in a position of wanting someone else to apologize to us. We avoid those situations. And this is one more element that I think is just prevalent in our culture that pushes us into isolation more and more without even our conscious awareness that it's happening. This attempt to live a life that is free of hurt isn't humanly possible. But don't you feel yourself wishing for it? I certainly do. And I have to admit that actually what that is a fear-based life. It is not a life of faith. And Jesus is inviting us to something very, very different. So, the Bible does not talk about apologies. It does, however, talk about forgiveness. Rod and I were out in California in December at a large psychotherapy conference where Harriet Lerner was speaking. She's one of my favorite long-term authors. She wrote The Dance of Anger. Some of you, I've recommended it to lots and lots of people. She's gotten rich off that book and all the serial Dance of Intimacy, blah, blah, blah. She went on and on with that. But anyway, she's very entertaining presenter, kind of brilliant lady. Her books are written very well. So I went to hear Harriet Lerner, and she was talking about apologies. In fact, she was my inspiration for this sermon. As I sat and listened to her talk about apologies, she's now in her 70s, and she was looking at this subject, and she faltered when she came to try to talk about forgiveness as she discussed apologies. And she finally said, "I just don't understand forgiveness, so I've given up on it. I focus on letting go of anger and resentment. Forgiveness can be a religious thing," she admitted, "but it wasn't her thing." And I was so struck by that. And I think what I want to say to you is, please don't give up on forgiveness. It is really hard work. And Harriet Lerner is brilliant, but she is not a believer. And she doesn't have the help. I think it does elude us, as Lerner points out. It's beyond us in ways. But because of the presence of Jesus in our lives, because we live in a relationship with the living God, we can forgive. Not easily. But listen again to the importance that Jesus puts on it. Just in Matthew 6, you know, that famous prayer that we all learn, it says, "Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us." And even more clearly, just a tad later, "If you forgive those who sin against you, your heavenly Father will forgive you. But if you refuse to forgive others, your Father will not forgive your sins." We're going to come back to this issue of forgiving in a minute, but I just want to emphasize the real importance that Jesus places on this thing that Harriet Lerner was ready, is done. She's thrown it out the window. I really don't want us to do that. But let me get back to some things about good apologies, and then I'm going to go back into this issue of forgiveness. I think good apologies are a part of what it is to live a life that cares for relationship, that is about love. So, briefly, this is it. I'm sorry, it's my fault. What can I do to make it right? That's a good apology. Kind of a simple, little formulaic thing, but I have found it, even just since I kind of started thinking about this since early December, to be really deeply challenging to try to walk through that in my own mind and heart, let alone deliver it to another person. I actually think there's a bit more from Jesus about this process in Matthew 18. We get this brief bit. All of you who are good Anabaptists in the room, of course, know Matthew 18. All of you who aren't, you're welcome here anyway. But it talks about what we do when we screw up with one another. And what happens in Matthew 18 is Jesus is telling, kind of giving these mandates. And he says, if another believer sins against you, go privately and point out the offense. If the other person listens and confesses it, you have won that person back. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've read this passage. And suddenly now I'm looking at it again and saying, oh, you have won that person back. That's what I'm supposed to be aiming for. Not aiming for maybe formulaically even just making a good apology myself to get myself off the hook somehow. Not just trying to elicit a conversation that actually gets the other person to apologize to me too. You know, none of that is what's in this. This is about connection. This is about the repair of relationship. And often I think we get lost in our resistance to Matthew 18, right? I experience it. We don't want to admit we're hurt. Oh, that didn't really bother me. It's no problem. We resist. It's scary. It's the fear that we have to consistently address in our hearts, right? That's the thing that Jesus keeps pushing on us about, if we're serious about following him. Jesus just does not let up on this. I wish he would. But he keeps coming back to, nope, face your fear over and over. Here again, he makes this very practical. Be vulnerable enough to go privately to someone who has offended you or hurt you and tell them about it. I mean, can you think of anything stupider, right? They hurt me. I'm going to go to them. They're going to hurt me some more. This is not a good idea, Jesus. And Jesus says, go anyway. He's not sympathetic about our fear. He wants us to go right at it. Go do this. And again, notice the outcome he is working on. You will have won that person back. This business of apologizing, or even giving your friend the opportunity to apologize to you, is important because there are disconnections and hurts happening all the time. That's the given, and we must mend them. We need to win each other back all the time. Wouldn't it be lovely if we could accept this about ourselves and one another? But we blame, it just builds up in us. Can you feel it? We on all levels, systemically, personally, it's hard, hard, hard. We goof up and need to go to one another and say, I've been hurt, and we need to stay open to the process of coming back together. It's normal. I only wish. We have to be open to the process of saying to another person, I'm sorry, it was my fault. What can I do to make it right? Apologies are the basic stuff of relationship. It's reconnecting. It's not who's right and who's wrong. Jesus just doesn't care about that. But he does care that we reconnect, that we make these mendings of our relationships, even as a demonstration of our love for God. So don't go. If you don't feel love for the other person in the moment, count that as normal. But go for the love of God. And this little three-step formula for apologizing is helpful. However, I would contend that we need to pray, and pray a good bit, before we can say this to someone. So let me work on the other side of this for a minute. Try to identify what not to do, a little bit with me here. Don't say you're sorry if you don't think you have something to apologize for. That doesn't mean that you don't have something to apologize for, by the way. It just means that a real apology simply has to be sincere. If you don't think you've done anything wrong, but you know the other party does think you've done something wrong, spend some time considering why they might possibly feel that way. Engage your imagination. Try to put yourself in their shoes. Try to have empathy for their experience. Try to resist the process that we all go through in terms of dehumanizing them and distancing. They're bad somehow. Try to let them be real, whole, with their own needs, their own sense of right and wrong and all that stuff. Does this help you if you pause, if you pray? Does that help you change your mind about making an apology? Sometimes. It's really hard work. But I think what Jesus is getting at is getting us down into that place where we're really looking at our intentions. What did you intend when you were mad at that other person and you screamed at them? What did you intend when you made an apology that was perhaps dismissive? Apologies can be that too. Do I want to make him feel as bad as he made me feel? Absolutely, I want that. And we have to get under those sorts of mixed motives and get some help with that, maybe, before we can apologize with any real sincerity. So the goal has to get clarified inside us. And Jesus says the goal is always mend the relationship, win back the connection. So here's some tips if you decide to try this. Say it short. The other person will shut down. I'm thinking about tips now if you're trying to articulate your hurt to another person who might need to apologize to you. Our research shows us if you ask for the apology, you're probably not going to get it. So we keep working with this, right? Say it shorter. I'm not going to get into the neurobiology of this, but the person will shut down. Their neural net will shut down. Their frontal lobes, their cerebral cortex will actually disconnect from the signals they're getting from their midbrain, their limbic system. So they're going to shut down. They're not even going to hear you. Their defenses get triggered. And if our goal is honestly reconnection, then we have to take into account this basic human response. So say it shorter. Try to avoid blame, right? This is really hard for us to do. We are all wired for defense, and we feel that when we want to go to the person and blame. That's why blame is so easy for us. But we're trying to get to this place where we can honestly acknowledge our own feelings and be open to their feelings. A lot of us want to try to connect frontal lobe to frontal lobe. Build the case. He or she will understand my case, right? And we'll connect again. And human beings do not, I don't care how intellectual you are, human beings do not relate on that level. We relate feeling to feeling, midbrain to midbrain, at least with people that we love. And so, it's hard work. I just want to say two things and then I'm going to move on from this, because there are a couple of pitfalls and I could say a ton about all of this. But particularly to women, we're known for over-apologizing, kind of apologizing for each and every kind of thing. And that, too, can have a bit of a defensive function, kind of get, it's a smokescreen to move away. You know, I'm sorry I hurt you and blah, 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 and all of that. And the real issue here is how to allow ourselves to be vulnerable enough to connect more deeply. So there's this risk for over-apologizing that can actually create distance. It's also pretty irritating for people who have to endure it. You get the idea. The key here is to try to listen to the hurt party's anger and pain, to what's underneath maybe even their words, if we're looking for that kind of reconnective thing that Jesus is talking about. But the reality of all our lives is that we have some entrenched and the non-apologizers in our lives. The great harm that happens in this process, particularly for people who have been deeply traumatized across the whole Me Too movement that we're aware of now and that some of you may have unfortunately needed to participate in, the more harm that has been done, the less likely you'll get an apology. So we suffer. Again, I could say more about this, but I'll leave it just with, I think for the, like my mom, my entrenched non-apologizer, underneath, deeply concealed, is a radical lack of self-worth, I think, that prevents offering an apology, that prevents taking any responsibility for the hurt that inevitably happens in relationships one with another. I think harmed parties, particularly when there's trauma, walk a kind of tightrope when they want to bring up a conversation about their hurt. For some, it's actually a seeking of some kind of validation that this was real and that it really happened. Often then they walk right into becoming re-traumatized because an entrenched non-apologizer won't apologize. They, as I came to understand with my mom, she couldn't. And that had to do with who she was and what she had experienced. It doesn't mean they are good. It just means they are limited. And it doesn't mean that the hurt wasn't real. I think that's the key thing. We need to know that there was real hurt that happened. So speaking as a psychologist for just a moment, I want to add that the level of damage to people is really immeasurable here. And that's why I wanted to talk about something just as simple as three steps to a good apology and how I think good apologies are really hard to find. Because we are damaged, and some of us are so deeply damaged by what others have done to us. And this just simply, I just couldn't go by without acknowledging that's just a real thing. There is no excuse for this, but there is the reality that others may have an inability to actually develop the empathy that you might need. They just can't acknowledge the truth. They can't manage these higher level skills of being a human being. And the fact that they are around in our world, even at powerful positions in our culture, in our society, that's just true. I want to close with this, back to this topic of forgiveness that Harriet Lerner noted such confusion about. I think as Christians, the teaching of Jesus is loud and clear. When we find in ourselves this impulse to blame, we are on a precipice, and we must find a way to allow mercy to be our guide. Again, in Matthew 18, Jesus encourages us in kind of harsh words. I'm not going to read you the parable of the unforgiving debtor, but I do want to give you a synopsis of it. You can go read it on your own. Find Matthew 18 sometime tonight. But the gist of the story is this. A king is settling his accounts, and in the process, he responds with mercy to a servant who owes him just enormous sums of money. Then that same servant goes out, finds somebody else who owes him money, way less, and just throttles them, gets ready to throw them into prison because they have to pay him back immediately. So the one who received mercy offered no mercy. And others, of course, narc on this person, they report back to the king, and then the king in Jesus' story goes back and ultimately admonishes his listeners to forgive your brothers and sisters from your heart. He says, if you refuse to choose this, you're going to be in prison, and you're going to end up feeling tortured. And I think that's true psychologically. We've kind of got the evidence of that. Forgive your brothers and sisters from your heart. Now, wrestling with our resistance to just an apology and with all the trouble we have figuring out if we can offer a sincere apology, if we should, is there really grounds for any of this to happen? We have this opportunity, I think, in the middle of this to meet God. we can learn so much about our deeper lost selves if we will struggle honestly with God in the midst of what we can't do. And we should be able to own up to that. I can't do it. I cannot. There was a point in my life where I had to really wrestle. I could not forgive my mother. I'll say more about that in a minute. But forgiveness has to do with seeing the complexity of the one who hurt us. Apologizing has to do with seeing the complexity of ourselves. Mercy is needed in both of these contexts and in learning to offer good apologies and in learning to forgive each other and even those who never offer the apology that we long for. Forgiving from the heart, as Jesus calls us to do, demands, I think, that we stay connected with God first. It's about connecting to other people, and we can't manage it. We cannot manage it. We're going to throw it out the window along with Harriet Lerner unless we stay connected to God. So talk to God when you feel hurt. Talk a lot. Listen to yourself as you do this. Ask God to help you uncover why you were hurt and the depth of it. Go into your suffering rather than avoiding it. Go into it rather than denying it, rather than toughing it out alone, etc. You will learn important things there in the heart of it. You'll find that the conflict helps you to see your own wounds internally that you carry with you constantly, hidden. And the person who has hurt you has merely triggered those old, deep hurts. It's not that the person didn't hurt you. It's that the response in you is as deep as it is because of what you carry. It's a window for you to know yourself better and to find care from God for those inner wounds in yourself. From there, you can decide how you will deal with the person outside. This is the heart work. This is heart work of the first order, I would say. So going back to my story with my mom, my entrenched non-apologizer, it took me years of prayer. Actually, I would say decades. but I finally came to see how much she had hurt me. And when I could acknowledge that, I found new paths to respond to her and actually to others as well. I found mercy welling up in me then. And at the end of her life, I could confidently say I had loved her well. And in the last few months of her life, she even told me that she loved me. She said it right out loud. That had never happened in my life before. And that was really new, and it was wonderful. But we had pretty much missed a whole lifetime of being connected intimately at that point. She couldn't do this hard heart work. But God, in his mercy, had worked in me for love to triumph nonetheless. So let God teach you to forgive. My hope is that our thinking together tonight about just practical steps in making apologies might help us along this path to forgiveness. Our God is rich in mercy, and this is the reason we can hope to forgive. It draws us into our suffering and invites us to live freely and not to blockade ourselves from others and from ourselves in this impulsive attempt to avoid suffering. This avoidance in us always leads to a very narrow life where good apologies and the glory of forgiving elude us.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect drop-down at circleofhope.net.